Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Maurice Carlos Ruffin, whose new story collection is The Ones Who Don't Say They Love You. Maurice Carlos Ruffin is one of New Orleans' brightest literary stars. He made his debut in 2019 with the critically acclaimed dystopian satire, We Cast a Shadow. And now he's back with a story collection, The Ones Who Don't Say They Love You, one of the most eagerly anticipated books of this summer. Maurice is a New Orleans native, studied law at Loyola University, creative writing at the University of New Orleans. He's now a professor of creative writing at Louisiana State University, and he's just back from a stint as John and Renee Grisham Writer-in-Residence at the University of Mississippi. Maurice, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hey, Susan, I'm so happy to be back home and having my first interview for this book with you of all people.
And you're just back.
I just got back, so yeah.
Now, first of all, tell us about the title, which is so provocative, especially when you take it with the jacket.
Yeah. So The Ones Who Don't Say They Love You, one of my very good friends when I was in grad school, she was a master at making great titles. Her name is Chae Yoon. And I just had like very simple titles. I wasn't very good at them. And I would just read her stories and then read the title afterwards and go, how does she do this? So one of her stories was called One in 10 Fish Can't Swim. So provocative, you know, so thoughtful. And I've just made it the point to try and have the kind of titles that make you go, you know, what is going on here? And I think New Orleans is one of those cities where, you know, you'll love it. It may not love you, but you're getting something wonderful out of it. And so I think a lot of my characters in this book are having that kind of experience. They love the city so much, and this is home for them. And yet many of them are having hard times.
Yeah. It's a matter of trust for a lot of them. Do you trust the people who say they love you or do you not?
Oh, yes. Sometimes people who do not say they love you are the most trustworthy people.
Absolutely. So the stories in this collection were written over a number of years, right?
Yes.
So when did they coalesce for you as a collection? And tell me about some of the tweaks and more recent things, because, you know, there's kind of a range here. There's a Katrina story. There's an historical story set in 1886, and there are mentions of pandemic masks, so it's right up to date in some ways. So talk about how you survey a group of stories like this and put them together.
Yeah, that's a great question, Susan. I think this collection was designed to encompass a wide swath of New Orleans culture and society. It spans about 154 years, if you go back to 1866, give or take. And I just wanted to sort of show the people of New Orleans who have not been seen before. You know, there aren't that many books that come out of New Orleans necessarily, and even fewer by African Americans. And so I just thought that for me, you know, all these people that I've run into in my life, all these wonderful stories, I want to be the person who brings those to light for people. So, you know, the oldest story is set in 1866, and this is a woman who's just, you know, going to work and gets attacked by a man in the French Quarter, and she gets her revenge on him for that. The last story in the collection in terms of time is set during the George Floyd protest in 2020, and these are two teenagers, recent graduates from high school, you know, one who's non-binary, the other one's a trans girl, and they're just trying to, like, be a part of this process of making our city a better place.
Shaquan and Freddie.
Yes.
I love them.
Yes, I love them too.
So much. I love Freddie saying that they didn't want to choose the pronouns when they could have all of them. It was like,
That's right.
Going home with a gift in your hand and leaving behind the gifts behind.
That's right. And New Orleans is very open to that. People are very accepting of who you are. And it's one of the things that I think is underappreciated about our hometown. People say, well, you know, it's Southern or it's small or whatever. It's like, well, no, we're actually very complex and people can be themselves here, which is one of our greatest attributes.
And it's a great place for young people to come and or to be and seek out themselves.
Yes, absolutely.
Know? Now, New Orleans is a character in this book, of course. So When you think of New Orleans and you're coming up with these characters, what comes first? I mean, I'm often curious as you look at some of these voices. I mean, a lot of these short stories are like monologues. They're written mm-hmm. in the first person. I often wonder if, are you creating the person or are you channeling the voice, you know?
Yeah, the stories always come as an idea first. So, you know, one of the stories in the collection is, you know, what if this young man is going to a party and he is going to be working as a caterer? And for the first time, he recognizes that there are different ways to live a life. He can, you know, maybe not be somebody involved in mugging people or something like that. And he sees, you know, people who are doing well in their lives. But the idea is always secondary. I have the idea. I try to write it. It doesn't work well the very first time. And then the voice hits me. And for me, it's more of a seance. In some cases, it's like ancestors that I'm listening to. In other cases, it's like people that I knew in some alternate reality life that I've actually lived somewhere else. And I think it's the reason why this book, you know, took about 10 years to write. I don't want to just like bang something out. I want to make sure that the voices are authentic, that these people have real concerns, that there's no wasted effort. If you ask any of my characters, what was the most important moment in your life, they're going to tell you one of these stories. These stories are the most important moments in your lives.
And how did this work with the novel? Was it hand in hand? Was it alternating? How did you balance both writing projects over the span of time?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. They definitely fed back and forth to each other. So there's one story in here called Ghetto University, which is one of the most sort of humorous satirical stories. And that character is very much like the narrator in my novel, We Cast a Shadow. So I think I wrote that story kind of like as an experiment to see, like, well, what if I took him out of his context and changed him around, you know, gave him a different relationship with his partner. And so it definitely helped me figure some things out in the book that only the story could help me figure out. And many of the characters who are in this short story collection, I think you could say that they exist in the same universe as We Cast a Shadow, although you don't see them because they're in a different time period.
Mm-hmm. We'll read a little bit from Ghetto University. Let us hear his voice.
I'd love to. Ghetto University. This is a good time of year for mugging. The convention trade is only half as good as it used to be, but the discount rates have drawn out bargain hunting organizations. Last Wednesday, the World Commission on Peace stopped by. Next week, the NRA. Tonight, the International Association of Lepidopterists. Even though there are virtually no interesting butterflies in New Orleans at all. I wear a butterfly brooch on my hoodie to blend in. And the brooch is somewhat in the shape of a blue morpho. The silhouette is correct, but the spots, they're all wrong. Tourists commit all the right sins for my purposes. Gluttony, sloth, pride. They spend their days devouring cliches. Salty gumbo, po' boy sandwiches with crusty exteriors and soft, chewy interiors. And sweet, powdery beignets. By evening, they're stuffed to their medullas. Lounging on the bench in Jackson Square, their bellies distended, they say, would it be nice if we went to see the plaque where the slave auction block used to be? It would be a blast. Jack and Lydia were here, and they didn't get to see it. We could post pictures on social media and rub their noses in our good fortune. And then the tourists wander off without a map. New Orleans is like a brick. You pour water on it, and there's no telling where the rivulets will run. When tourists trickle through our neighborhoods, they puddle in places they would have done well to avoid. Like this courtyard, where spider-like I'm hanging out behind a stand of poplar trees. A French family has fallen onto my web. Four of them this time. A disgruntled man, a cigarette-sucking woman, a teenage girl on a cell phone, and a boy in a frilly baseball cap, rakishly tugged sideways. I know what you're thinking. He's not going to mug a family with kids. But you see, it's already done. A simple shuffle into their path with the grace of Muhammad Ali in his prime. Papa, the boy says, misinterpreting our tableau. Le rappeur, c'est MC Solar. I quickly clear up their confusion. And next thing, I've acquired two new cell phones, a wad of euros, which I convert shortly, and the most delightful Nicholas of Mira pendant, the jolly old saint of pawnbrokers and thieves. Quelle chance. Guilt? I feel none for three reasons. First, although my prey thinks otherwise, I'm unarmed. I have no gun, no knife, no club. If anything, I have only a face and a body that are, in a sense, weaponized. And it's nothing illegal about people giving me currency, portable electronics, or heirloom jewelry of their own free will. I've never once asked my patrons for a dime. I'm just a very aggressive beggar, if one really considers it.
Oh, Maurice, you are watching, and you're watching everything. Poor tourists, gluttony, sloth, and pride.
Hey, I mean, that's why they come down. Well, some of them come down for that.
It's true.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that voice. Now, when we talked about We Cast a Shadow, you said you thought, you hoped, you had written a very American book about a very American city with a very American problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem was kind of, in many ways, laser-like focused in that book and very sharp and defined.
Mm-hmm.
And in this book, that's what you've done again, but you've written about a whole host of other problems and things like tourism, mm-hmm. as we just heard, gentrification, blight, taxes. And it's a landscape that can be very dispiriting, but the characters brighten it immeasurably. So you're taking on a lot of social ills and economic inequity here. And that's, you know, money is not something people write about in fiction, or else they write about it all the time. I'm still trying to figure that out. So talk about taking on those things.
Well, I definitely wanted to do something I hadn't seen done before, which is, you know, New Orleans is known for its music and its food and its architecture and so many other parts of its culture. There's a T-shirt from a few years back where they would say, you know, everything you love about New Orleans is because of black folks. But the idea that we have so many great storytellers, but we don't get to see it in literature so much. So the book took a long time because I was very systematic in the kinds of stories I wanted to tell. So, for example, the biggest story in the book is the last one is called Before I Let Go. And that's a song with a very New Orleans connection because of Frankie Beverly coming down to Jazz Festival. But also the main character, Gelia, who's named for my auntie, she is a sort of quintessential New Orleans woman. You know, she's black. She is in her 40s. She has a daughter who's sort of moved out of town for more opportunities. She's trying to keep from losing her house that's been in her family since her grandmother's time, who passed it to her mother and then down to Gelia herself. And she's being pestered by the city to pay back taxes. And her neighbors have all either left or died off, or Katrina pushed them out, or insurance is being gentrified. And she's just trying to make a few dimes to stay in town, whether it's driving an Uber or, you know, being a part-time waitress for some catering service. And so for me, you know, these people, we need to see them. We get plenty of New York stories, plenty of California stories, but not enough New Orleans stories. And I just hope that people both from this city and outside of the city, they'll see us for who we actually are. People who may not be in the wealthiest city, the fanciest city, but who do have an unbreakable spirit that manifests in things like jazz funerals or how we come to Mardi Gras and have a great time. We come together always because we are very hopeful and very strong. And that's an inner strength that goes back for many, many, many generations.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Maurice Ruffin, whose new book is The Ones Who Don't Say They Love You. This is a book full of young people and kids and parents. And I think whenever you have stories about children and parents, you're inevitably leading to hope and disappointment.
Yes.
So talk a little bit about the different kinds of families we see in this book.
Yeah, I think that for many people, that point in your life where you are either partnered up or you have children is a very sort of intense moment. You have these dreams and hopes that you're still battling towards, and yet you're responsible for other people in your life. I think for this collection, why there aren't so many older people is because in my experience, I have many friends in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. They've just figured a lot of things out. They're kind of over putting on a show for people. They really understand themselves. I think for many of these characters, they're really trying to set priorities. And so, you know, one of the stories in the book is that there's a mother and son. And in the opening chapter, the mother, you know, asks the son to find all the bottles of alcohol that she's hidden around the house so that, you know, she'll pay him $5 per bottle and she wants to get sober so she can go out and find a job for the family. And you can sort of tell in the story, she hasn't really figured it out yet. She's not sure that she's to that place as a person yet. And many of the characters are like that. They're in transition.
And the poor kid who has to help his mother quit drinking.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's a really showstopper of a beginning,
yeah.
I think. So talk about some of the others. Talk about the dad who gets out of Angola and finds so many things stacked against him.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, it's such a common story. I mean, we understand now, I think, how the war on drugs in combination with mass incarceration just so unfairly destroys so many communities. The idea that you could have, like, even in the story itself, you know, he's trying to find good work. He goes down to, like, the sorority row near Tulane University. And you sort of sense that, like, inside of these different frat houses, like, they're probably doing drugs inside right now. You know, whatever. It could be, you know, Molly, MDMA, whatever. And yet he's gone to jail in the past for breaking all kinds of laws. And it just shows you how unfair that system is. So for this man, you know, he sort of sees the whole picture. He knows that the system's unfair. And yet when his son says, well, you know, Dad, you didn't do anything wrong. He says, son, you know, I got caught. And that's kind of what matters here. For me to be free, I just have to be the kind of person who just is not involved in that kind of life anymore. It's going to be hard for me to do that, but I'm going to try my best. And I think he's one of the few characters where I think he really is, like, he's sincere, he understands himself, and his son is trying to figure out if he wants to follow in the same footsteps. Because the son also sees how unfair things are, and he just is not quite having it yet. And that's where a lot of the tension in that story comes from.
Now, I want to talk about one character who is, oh, I know this is so terrible, but the great specter of this summer is having your car broken into. And here you have this young person who's in the driveway. So talk about writing that story, that moment of, if you're unlocked or if you're locked or alarmed, here I am. You know, it's just
that one. So that's Fast Hands, Fast Feet.
I love that title too.
Oh yeah, thank you. Yeah, a young woman. She's living on the streets and she's just trying to keep warm one night in the middle of the, you know, cold spell. And it's funny because it's kind of based on a true story. My car got broken into like 3 times in like a 6-month period. I still have the same car right now. It's a Volkswagen. It has like scratches from when these things happened in the past. I remember walking outside, opening my door up and realizing they had been ruffled through. Like the glove box was open. Yeah. There was change on the floor. I was like, okay. And I'm like, well, I call the police for this. And I kept thinking, you know what? They must have needed it more than I needed it. And in fact, that first break-in happened like within a week of me buying the car. It was a brand new car, right? Oh. So I was really frustrated. But I kept thinking, you know what? What is the story of this person? Like, why were they in my car? What did they need in that moment? Mm-hmm. And she came to me. Again, that voice, I just sat down one day and just started writing and thinking about, you know, who would be that desperate to go in somebody's driveway in their car and just start going through the different things. And she's one of the spunkiest characters in the book. I mean, she just wants to be left alone and live her own life. And there's this man named Sarge, who's also homeless, who's kind of like, you know, you're just a girl. You can't take care of yourself on the streets in the middle of the night in New Orleans. You need family. And so he tries to become that. And the tension is sort of this odd couple flavor between these two characters trying to look out for each other in that story.
You're giving a voice to everybody.
I'm trying.
So I'm curious about technique, because one of these stories, Spinning, for example, is really a prose poem. Mm-hmm. You know, some of them are flash fiction. Some of them are as long as a novella. So what appeals to you most? And do you know what it is when you set out, or does it reveal itself to you?
I'm very thankful. And that's a great question, Susan. For all my mentors and peers I've met throughout the years. So there's a local writer and professor named John Diguenet. I'm sure you're familiar with him.
Sure.
And John was gracious enough, almost 10 years ago now, when I hadn't written anything, to sit down with me in a coffee shop and talk for 3.5 hours about writing. And I've never forgotten how he said, you know, I said, John, how do you write? You've written novels, short story collections, you've written plays. How do you do it? He said his father was a carpenter and his father could build a house all by himself, you know, from the foundation to the studs in the walls, to the roof, to the plumbing. A writer should have that versatility. And I think that for me, I pride myself on having this sort of range. And, you know, I sort of had pushed back for a while. People would say, you know, in introductions, Maurice Ruffin, poet. And I had written like one poem. And finally, I gave in recently. I've written maybe, you know, a dozen or a couple dozen poems now. And I thought with this collection, there was one in particular that fit this sort of feeling. There's many stories about sort of parents and children. And this was about a child thinking back on his own father previously. And it's really based upon my own father, to be perfectly honest about it. And I just thought this would go great, very well. It's not a short story, but it kind of is.
Yeah.
It's a poem, I think. Mm-hmm. And I love the fact that you're reading the book, you don't see it coming. You're like, wait, what is this? Why is it, you know, why is it laid out like that? Well, it's a poem. That's why.
So you've done it all. I mean, I love some of the novella length stories. Before You Go is really my favorite, because that character is so rich. I mean, she's trying so hard to hang on to her house and the neighborhood too. And then her neighbors turn out to be such gentrifiers and ready to drive out the original people in that neighborhood, including, of course, the man who plays the trumpet.
Right.
And
right.
the way she stands up for that is just, it's a voice for all of us, I think, who love our neighborhoods.
It is funny. I actually wrote a story that features that the trumpet player. He's in a different story that's not in this collection.
Mm-hmm.
But I really thought with this book in particular, I've been thinking about Black women. I'm a Black man myself, obviously. But how people will ask questions about their experiences. You know, just now I saw that Simone Biles dropped out of the Olympics. It's so sad, you know, because of stress, basically. And similar things with Osaka, you know, the tennis player, Naomi Osaka. And I just felt like, you know what, if I can take a breath and allow a story about a Black woman to just play out completely, not use any tricks or techniques. And so she gets about 40 pages. I mean, it's the biggest story in the book. And for me, it just felt really good to allow her voice to be heard over that long period where she's interacting with these different characters, but it's always her as the lead character. Mm-hmm. I can see her being played by like Octavia Spencer or somebody like that.
You bet.
You know, in the book.
Octavia, are you listening? Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
And I love her voice. You know, I love the way she thinks about things. And I'm also fascinated by the story of the daughter who lives in Japan.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's like, how'd that happen? It was amazing.
Yeah, I have to give points to my friend Nafisa Thompson Spires. She had a great book a few years ago called The Heirs of Colored People. And she had a story in there where she had these two characters who were so different. And one of them was a guy who was into anime. And I'm like, I've never seen a Black character who's young in anime, you know, in a book. And I was like, all right, so maybe Gelia's daughter is an English teacher who moves to be a teacher in Japan, and there's now she's doing cosplay, you know, somewhere in rural Japan. So it just felt fun and good to me to do that.
And that's how a writer's mind works.
Absolutely.
A little bit here, a little bit there.
Absolutely.
So talk about the pandemic year for you. I mean, in some ways, you were away in Oxford, but, you know, things happened there too. So what was this year like?
Yeah, I mean, it was so uncertain because I remember, you know, they were asking, are you going to still come out to Oxford and teach at University of Mississippi? You know, to explain, so the way it was set up is that I got to live on 78 acres in this gigantic house. It's actually John Grisham's old house with two ponds and a tennis court with a basketball goal on it. It was just this wonderful thing. Now, I'll say, you know, Mississippi, this northern part is very quiet, so I was a little nervous at first. I mean, I'm a city person. You know,
used to the noise.
It was so quiet, you know, and just like the sort of history of it, there were cotton fields all around. That was kind of nerve-wracking at first, too.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, and I mean this sincerely, it was one of the greatest experiences of my entire life. After the first 2 or 3 months of settling in, that level of peace and quiet was really good for me. I actually wrote about 100 pages of a book while, you know, in that 4 month period, got tired of it. I was like, this is not going to work very well. Started a new book in December. Finished the entire first draft in 5 months, which for me is like 5 times faster than normal.
Wow.
And, you know, it was really just being able to hear like my ancestors' voices and my friends' voices and think about my own personal concerns as a writer and just be in that space and have my own schedule. And it was just perfection. It was what I want to be at some point in the future.
So is the one you finished in the pipeline now?
I'm in the second draft phase. It feels very, very good. I've never felt that good about a first draft. And for it to take only 5 months, to me, is still astounding. And that book is very much about me trying to understand sort of my ancestors, but telling fictional versions of their stories. And so it goes back even further than the story in this book. It starts in 1844 and follows my great-great-great-great-grandmother's generation and their lives. And it skips around in time to the 1940s and then to the future after that, like 2118, which is the 400th anniversary of New Orleans.
Oh, we'll be waiting. Don't take so long.
I am on my way, I promise you.
We've been talking with Maurice Carlos Ruffin, whose splendid new book is The Ones Who Don't Say They Love You. You can meet him Tuesday, August 17th at 6 at Community Book Center on Bayou Road. Maurice, thank you so much.
Oh, I love this so much. Thank you, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, the Jefferson Parish Library's Comic-Con, the comic book mini-convention that was scheduled for Saturday, August 14th at the East Bank Regional Library, has been canceled due to COVID concerns. Free Comic Book Day is being celebrated August 14th at the New Orleans Public Library. Starting at 10 a.m., visit any library location for a free comic book supplied by Crescent City Comics. While you're there, sign up to participate in a raffle to win an additional giveaway. Supplies are limited, distributed on a first-come, first-served basis. Mask up. The Octavia Books Science Fiction Book Club is discussing Sarah Pinsker's Song for a New Day, Saturday, August 14th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Blue Cypress Books will host the Lucky Bean Poetry Reading, Monday, August 16th from 6 to 8. Farah Roshan appears in conversation with Marty Dumas to discuss her new novel, The Dating Playbook. That's the second in the Boyfriend Project series. Takes place Tuesday, August 17th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Maurice Carlos Ruffin discusses and signs The Ones Who Don't Say They Love You, Tuesday, August 17th at 6 at Community Book Center on Bayou Road, again Tuesday, August 24th at 6 at Blue Cypress Books, and again Tuesday, August 31st at 6 at Octavia Books. And news from Baton Rouge. The Louisiana Book Festival, scheduled for October 30th at the State Capitol Complex, has been canceled due to COVID concerns. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.